The format of today's meeting is the leader qualifies for 5 minutes, followed by the main speaker. My name's Annette, and I'm an alcoholic. In my group, when we're asked to lead a meeting, we usually dress a little bit more with respect to the program, but I just found out. Okay, God, you take over. I'm very touched. I'm touched that it's beautiful. I'm touched that you're all here. I'm touched that my two boys are working, and I know where they are. The long time I waited for the phone to ring, I never knew if it was going to be jail or hospital. I needed Al-Anon then. And I took up drinking. It just kind of snuck up on me. There's nothing in my past that would have said, she's going to be an alcoholic. I didn't come from a home like that. I wasn't abused. And there was nothing there. My kids started drinking, so I caught it from them. I don't know what happened. I don't know. I just started drinking, and I couldn't stop. I drank a lot. I drank because I really couldn't cope. I just couldn't cope. I couldn't cope with life. I didn't know what else to do. It just seemed like the only thing that would kind of quiet my head down and pass out, and I just couldn't cope. I couldn't cope with my life. I'd lost the ability to control what was going on around me, and it was very painful. It's not that tragic. It just happened to be very painful to me. It wasn't tragic at all. It just, my both kids were just a mess. I had a daughter that was great right in between. She was born with a spiritual program and never needed to do anything to make it any different, and she's right in between. They're less than 4 years apart, I drank until I just couldn't drink anymore, and then I started writing suicide notes and attempting suicide because I did not want to live in this life, I'm so glad that I found the program. Steve got here first, and I don't know why I surrendered and decided that maybe there was something. I remember one day asking him, "Do you think I would like that?" And he says, "Mom, you'd like it because it's a program of people that have put their lives together, and I'm a sucker for a happy ending like that. So I thought I'd come and hear your happy endings. I mean, I just like happy stories. You know, if Lassie made it home, I would cry. So I just figured, well, I'm just going to go and hear happy stories. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I didn't come for recovery. And I haven't had a drink since my very first meeting. I didn't hear you don't take pills. I had a few Valium habits there, but I thought that if you didn't drink, you qualified. And I wanted to come to your meetings because I felt good there. And I stayed around long enough and got Millie as a sponsor and a home group. And she explained to me, we don't take anything. And so I started with a sponsor, a new home group, and a clean sobriety. And I am so grateful. I have 14 years and 10 months. And then we had to wait. Guy will have 10 years, so we had to wait a while to watch him kill himself for a while until he got here. And now we each have a program, and I'm so grateful. I'm grateful to God, to the program, to the people, to all of you to make our lives so rich and so full. I hope we have a wonderful weekend. I don't think last year I said it takes time to adjust even to paradise. I think that it won't take me any time to adjust to this. It's been wonderful, and I just got here today, so it's a good start. Okay, let's have that real person here. Thank you. Thank you. The real meeting person here, Dr. Paul's going to speak.
I think I'll play with this and save them all that trouble. My name is Paul, and I'm a full-blown alcoholic. And I'm delighted to be here. And as you noticed, that's why I dressed for the occasion. I'm glad to be here, and I'm delighted you're here. It would sure be a dull meeting if you weren't here. I'm not only glad to be here, I'm glad to be an alcoholic. I just love being an alcoholic. I love this way of life. I love sobriety. I love anybody's sobriety, particularly my own. And I just love being an alcoholic. It's the best life I've ever known. And if that bothers you to hear me say that, that's too damn bad, I guess. If you don't understand it, ask your sponsor. And if your sponsor doesn't know, get another sponsor. So I'm glad to be here. And I feel very privileged to be the, here we go. thank you. If you missed any of that, I can start over. So where was I? I will start over. I'm glad I'm here. Yeah. I wasn't listening to what I was saying. Were any of you? I'm really lost. I know. I started to say I was privileged to be the first scheduled speaker. That's what it was. And I guess it's up to me to welcome you to, and so I do. I really welcome all of you to my favorite alcoholism treatment facility. I hear some chuckles in the audience, and I'm not chuckling. This is a fatal disease, a progressive terminal disease that we're working on here, and a lot of people come to Club Med just for the fun of it. And by God, we're a bunch of sickies. We're here to get well. And I think it's a major part of the recovery. Is to me, one of the major aspects of recovery from our disease is the people. It was as Annette said, it's the people. I mean, the first word of the first step is we. And the whole philosophy is that I can't stay sober, you can't stay sober, but we can stay sober. And as I understand the traditions say that as important as the individual is, the group is even more important, that if the groups die, we all die. And it's so that, as I see it, the relationships and the people we meet while we're here are perhaps more important than anything else that will go on during this week here. And indeed, as I'm saying that, I'm thinking you meeting each other is more important than anything I'm going to say up here. So why don't you take a few minutes now to stand up and hug three people that you don't really know all that way. Get to know each other right now. Don't wait till the last day. Do it now. That's called losing control of the audience. one of the major things too about this week is that there's so many of us that we've taken over the entire club. And let's give yourselves a hand. The importance of that to me is that anybody you run into is one of us. So no matter who they are, give them a smile, give them a handshake, preferably give them a hug. They all need it, and that's how we get to know each other. And the problem I have with that is I get so used to doing that for a week here that I find myself in the airport, in the lounge, in the men's room. Real difficult, but it's worth the trouble. I encourage you all, run around hugging and so on. And as he said, these are very generic meetings. It's not strictly AA, they're generic. So anything goes. And the attitude adjustment meeting, you don't have to be an alcoholic to come. God knows the Al-Anons need their attitudes adjusted too. And also, there's an Al-Anon meeting at 11 o'clock every day, and every one of you is eligible to be there. I mean, all you have to do is have a relative or a friend who is an alcoholic. And I'm your friend, so you're eligible. So I'll come to the Al-Anon meeting. I mean, if you've never been to an Al-Anon meeting, start coming. I mean, people at home won't even know unless you tell them. And so it's safe. And if you don't see the kind of meeting you want, start it. It's okay. You have all kinds of meetings. I talked to Jan, and she was wondering if they'd have any yoga group. Where is Jan? Is she here? Maybe she's off doing some yoga someplace. So do anything, start anything you want. Anything goes, well, almost anything goes. And so anyways, we're here to have fun. And this is a much better way. This is the best treatment I've ever seen. It's better than, I tell you, they have sports here of all kinds. And they're always yelling on the microphone that they're going to have some kind of a sport activity. And you can go or not go. The treatment facility I was at, the announcement came up and it said, "We are now going to play volleyball." And it was a declarative statement. We are going to play volleyball. And it was always the same. The boys played the girls. And the bad part was the volleyball court was only the size of a volleyball court and just barely beyond the borders of the volleyball court was a concrete block wall. And it was high. And theoretically, it was to keep the ball from escaping. high concrete block wall. And it was very narrow, very small. And the girls always started off, it seemed like. And they'd throw the ball up there, hit it. And I was full of Thorazine. Here it comes. Better start moving. Then pretty soon a voice would say, "Here comes that goddamn wall." Yeah. And it was a form of cruel and unusual punishment. And here they have all kinds of arts and crafts and stuff. You can either do it or not do it. But that, where I was, they were fanatics on making a leather belt. I mean, you had to make a leather belt or something really useful, like an ashtray or something worthwhile. I don't think you could graduate until you made something useful. And I didn't get it. I didn't go for that. They tried to convince me that the quality of my life would improve if I learned how to make leather belts. I told them, I said, I have a whole wall just full of licenses and certificates and diplomas and things to prove that I've been educated well beyond my level of intelligence. And I don't see how learning how to make leather belts will improve my life in any way. I didn't understand the philosophy. And besides, I didn't understand the instructions. So that was the fault of that occupational therapist. I mean, I've always had a theory that if you don't understand a thing well enough, you can explain it to me. So I understand a thing you don't understand as well as you're supposed to. And she'd already explained it to me 3 times, and I wasn't going to embarrass her by asking her a 4th time. And, so I was sitting there myself. But I ended up, I remember sitting there commiserating with myself about the series of mistakes and misunderstandings and poor diagnoses and poor medical management. The nice guy like me ended up in a place like that. And while I was thinking about all this, a psychiatrist walked up behind me and asked, he is a dumb psychiatrist. He couldn't see that my problems were strictly marital. And so there's nothing funny about that. he said something about us, Max and I, being married 56 years. And for 28 of those, that's significant that we were married 56 years. It's significant because for 28 of those 56 years, Max drove me to drink on a daily basis. And now for 28 years, I've been sober. So I drank for 28 years. So you're nowhere near as impressed as I am. She drove me to drink for 28 years, and now I've been sober for 28 years. So we're even. I don't know what that means, but we're even. And it said that her boys drove her, that she got her alcoholism from her boys, and I understand that. Max was not everybody knows how they got to be alcoholic, but Max was raised by her grandmother and 2 alcoholic uncles, the Gensline boys. And my family knew that the Gensleins were alcoholics because they were boys were alcoholics. It was always in the Alliance Review that the Gensline boys were in jail for common drunk again. And as Max and I were growing up, my family did not like for me playing with the Gensline girl because they were afraid that if, when we got older, we might get married and I would turn out to be an alcoholic. And by God, they were right. And I'm an alcoholic by marriage. I wasn't an alcoholic when I married her. And anyway, I was sitting there in the nut ward, and the psychiatrist came up, and he wanted to know if I would talk to a man from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, God almighty. I thought, my God, Doc, I've got all these problems of my own. How could I be bothered with some drunk from AA? You know, I didn't know how to help. I didn't even want to know how to help him, but I could tell by the look on his face that he thought it was a good idea. And I don't know if you know that or not, but happiness on a nut wart is having a happy psychiatrist. And so I said, okay, and in no time at all, this clown comes galloping into the room, yelling at the top of his voice, my name is Frank, and I'm an alcoholic. Ah, I was embarrassed for him. There he is meeting a perfect stranger, and the only thing he can think of to say about himself is that he's an alcoholic, you know. And he talked forever. I don't remember a word he said. I don't remember a word he said, but I know he said it in a very loud voice. I was thinking, my God, man, why don't you lower your voice? I mean, these people all think I'm a nut. Why don't we just leave it at that? You know? And the last thing he said was, well, that's my story, and I'm going to a meeting tonight. Would you like to go along? And I said, hell no, I won't like it. But I'll go, because I figured he'd go back and squeal to the dumb psychiatrist. And indeed he would have. And we went off to a meeting. I have no idea what meeting we went to. A lot of people I hear talk about their first meeting. They who led and who read and who prayed and what the profound things people said. I don't know any of that. I don't know how many meetings we went to before I knew what meeting I was at. But I know that that first meeting had a profound effect on the psychiatrist. he was very impressed. He was asking all kinds of questions. What's this about a book? What's this about steps? What's this about me? How often do they have meetings? What other kind of meetings do they have? How soon are you going to go again? I thought, my God, I've got me an alcoholic psychiatrist. He's ashamed to go, so he's sending me. You know? I thought, I want to go to all the meetings I can and get all the brownie points I can and get out of this dump. And Frank was very good. He took me every day, and we got off to the meetings. I got enough brownie points that I got discharged. I had no intention of coming back to meetings. Why would I come back? I wasn't an alcoholic. But then I found out that Max liked the meetings. She's not an alcoholic. She started going to meetings with us. And she liked, well, of course, once I found out she liked the meetings, then I would threaten her. If she didn't shape up, by God, I wasn't going to go to meetings anymore. There's an Al-Anon down there. And that what happened, she wasn't even going to Al-Anon, but she got in the car and drove down the freeway and went to meetings by herself. Have you ever tried that? Have you ever tried sitting at home on a Saturday night, drinking, all by yourself, while your non-alcoholic spouse is off laughing it up at an AA meeting? Yeah. I had to go back to the meetings to find out what they were laughing about. I found out they laugh at anything. Laugh at nothing. I remember one night, I found myself laughing with them. And I haven't had a drink since. It was 7 months. It took 7 months. And I haven't had a drink since that time. In fact, I'm convinced that the laughter is very spiritual, very therapeutic. It has been for me, and I'm convinced that my higher power laughs every time he hears alcoholics or Al-Anons laugh, even if he doesn't understand the joke. He just likes to hear the laughter and joins in, and it's been, it took me 7 months. It took me seven months to become an alcoholic, and that's how I got it, by being around alcoholics, and just listening to what they have to say. And if you're here tonight, or this week, you're not alcoholic, You're in a pretty dangerous spot. You have to be very careful what you listen to. Keep an open mind. Keep an open mind. So whatever goes in goes right on through. But if somebody says something and you identify it and you think, oh, I did something like that. I felt like that. You suppose I might be an alcoholic. Boom, just like that, you're an alcoholic. I mean, once you suspect it, it's already too late. And you won't get any sympathy here. You turn to the other person and say, you know, I think I might be an alcoholic. Oh, we got another one. Put your hand up. You think they got a bonus for every new member or something. Alcoholics just love to infect other people. So be very, very careful. But you could catch worse things. Anyhow, that's what happened to me. And when I first became alcoholic, after 7 months, I was just barely alcoholic.
This is the end of side one. Stop the tape now, turn it over, and begin listening to side two without rewinding.
Just a little bit alcoholic. I mean, almost a non-alcoholic. But the trouble is that once I became an alcoholic, I wanted to be one of the sober ones, because I found out that there are some that are drinking and some that aren't drinking, and the ones that aren't drinking, the ones that are having all the fun, and having all the laughter, and so I had to give up drinking in order to be one of the sober alcoholics. And the only way I could do that was to keep going to meetings, and as I kept going to meetings, I kept getting reinfected. And so I'm much more alcoholic tonight than I was 28 years ago. It really is a progressive disease, whether you're drinking or not drinking. I'm much more alcoholic. I never became an addict, but I did develop a few pill problems. I mean, my prescription pills, they were medically prescribed. I mean, I never ever took a pill. I never ever took a pill unless I had the precise symptom that only that pill would relieve. I did. I either had it or I could feel it coming on. Every pill I took was medically indicated at the time and prescribed by a doctor and taken according to directions. Mine, you know. But I never became addicted, because the only way you can be addicted to pills is to ask any doctor. Ask your non-alcoholic doctor how his patients get hooked on pills. And he'll tell you two things. He'll say, well, none of his patients ever get hooked on pills. And the other thing is that no patient can get hooked on pills unless they abuse the pill. That's right. You have to abuse the pill. I mean, never the pill abuses the patient. It's the patient abuse the pill. I don't even know how to abuse the pill. How do you abuse the pill? You throw it up against the wall, you know, and stomp on the thing. Verbally abuse it. Well, you dirty, rotten little pill. Why don't you do it? Never abused the pill in my life. They're little tiny pills. Just to look at them, you knew they were very mild. And I was very careful with my pills. I was even very careful where I carried them. I used to carry them with my change. And people say, you got change for a dollar? I'd say, yeah. And I'd go like that. And they'd say, oh, you carry Tylenol around in the daytime. Yeah. And I'd put it over with my keys. And go out in the parking lot and I'd take my keys out of the pocket. And a Quaalude run down the street, you know. And it would always run faster than I could run, you know. And I didn't dare stomp on it or I'd abuse it, you know. I was very solicitous of my pills. And I certainly didn't become one of those dope fiends. I did dabble in a few narcotics, but that was only... Well, if I was going to prescribe those for patients, I ought to know something about it. It was more of a scientific study of this stuff. In fact, I had my own form of a Hippocratic oath in that I never ever gave a patient a drug or a pill that I hadn't first tried out on myself. The other day, I heard some guy was a He was abusing Demerol. He was wasting Demerol. He was injecting it in the muscle. And I thought, my God, Demerol is a beautiful, potent narcotic drug, and it should be treated with respect. And anybody with any sense knows you don't inject Demerol in the muscle. You put it right into the vein, for God's sake. And you don't use morphine. I mean, because morphine, it just makes my nose itch. Just a... Thank you very much. Well, that's going to be tricky. Look at me set this down with a thing. That's typical of me. Somebody does me a favor and I bitch about it. You know, didn't do it quite right, you know. If you didn't think I was alcoholic before, you know it now. My nose still itches just thinking about it. Morphine made my nose itch. And it also, I tend to vomit unpredictably. Patients never got used to that. But I haven't had a drink now in 28 years. I have not had a drink or a pill in 28 years. I mean, boy. Again, you're not nearly as impressed as I am. That's 28 years. That's the longest I have ever gone without a drink. I haven't even had a drink when I wanted one. I haven't even had a drink when I deserved one. I just haven't had a drink. That's the way it is in AA. That's the way it is in AA. We don't drink. We don't. Even when we want one, even when we deserve one, we just don't. We don't drink. We just don't drink under any occasion. We just don't drink. In fact, we're kind of noted for not drinking. I think if I'd had even an occasional, social, mild drink, I don't think I'd be standing here with 28 years. I think not drinking has had a lot to do with me being 28 years sober. And that's the way it's been for me. And I don't have any problems as a result of drinking because I don't drink. In fact, I haven't had a problem related to drinking in a long time. I still know that drinking is my number one problem. You don't have to remind me of that, but my basic day-to-day problem today is not related to my drinking, it's related to my thinking. I have a dual disease. Not only have a drinking problem, I have a thinking problem. My sponsor says, Paul, don't drink and don't think. And in fact, tonight I've caught three alcoholics thinking. And I probably saved their sobriety just by, hey, watch what you're doing. You know, if you catch any of us thinking, just catch us, stop it right away, because it really can be dangerous. And that thinking, I don't even have a problem today. I don't have a problem today, unless I think I do. And any problem I have is every problem I have is a thinking problem. Not even a problem unless I think it's a problem. I alone determine whether or not I have a problem. I alone determine the size of my problem. I don't have many little problems. I don't bother with them. Like resentments. I don't bother with any but the justifiable ones. And besides, if it is a little problem, all I have to do is think about it. And my mind is a tremendous energy factory. It creates tremendous energy, and it puts it out into whatever I think about, like a powerful laser beam or ultraviolet light or a searchlight. It'll be searching in the dark, looking around. Oh, that's an interesting problem you've got there. Could I borrow it for a while? You know, and I get to thinking about it, and I can just watch it grow. You just watch it. In fact, I don't even have to start with anybody else's problem or even my own. I can start with a non-problem. I say, well, hell, that's no problem. Oh, I suppose if you thought about it, it could be a bit of a problem. And I get to thinking about how maybe it could be a problem. And by God, it gets growing up. And I get fascinated with watching it grow. And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And pretty soon I'm really fascinated with this problem. And the reason I'm fascinated with it is because everybody else is missing it, you know. And here's this great big problem. And what happens is somebody calls me on the phone and they distract me from my problem. And I have to talk to them. You can't just give people a quick answer. You can't say, well, that's a dumb problem. You have to do active listening. You know, I shouldn't get into this, but the devil will make me do it. Where are you going? I bet we all know where you're going. You hurry back now. Yeah, I don't know where I was again. Was anybody listening? I wasn't listening. Anyhow, one of the things that bothers me the most is when somebody I'm working with says that somebody else told them, asked them to be their sponsor. And I'll say, well, what did you say? And he said, oh, no, I told him I didn't know the program well enough. Or I didn't know enough about sponsoring to sponsor. And it really annoys me. I say, you idiot. Their higher power and your higher power went to all kinds of trouble to get them to ask you to be their sponsor, and you say no. I mean, you can't. What do you want to do? Wait and go to sponsor school? It doesn't take any brains to be a sponsor. I know. No. As a matter of fact, anybody asks you to be your sponsor, and you think in terms of saying no, you don't know enough. Let me tell you, it's very easy to start. It's very easy to start. In fact, you can start sponsoring, and you can grow into the world's greatest sponsor, perhaps. And all you need to know to start is 5 words. They call you up, and they ask a question. And the answer could either be yes or no. You already know those words, yes or no. Or they may be calling from Cloud9, and they're really excited about what's going on. And then you say, wow. Yep. So you have yes, no, and wow. Or they say something else, and it's kind of intermediate between yes and no and wow. And it's like my sponsor's favorite word. Whatever I say to him, he says, whatever. If he's feeling real talkative, he'll say, well, whatever. So you got yes, no, wow, and whatever. If they're to go on talking, and you lose track, and you'll want to keep saying wow and whatever all the time, you want some variety, you say, really? Yes, no, wow, really, and whatever. And then if they really are the talkative type, and you run out of your 5 words, no matter what they say, you can always say, And in fact, you can play around with that, and they make it into you know, and you get all kinds of things out of That's a non-word. You get 5 words and a non-word, and it's really very easy to be a sponsor. Don't ever say no if somebody asks you to be a sponsor. Somebody's higher power went to a lot of trouble to ask you to do that. Anyhow, one of the reasons I'm having trouble talking to you, I'm trying to talk. You're sitting there nice and quiet, and I'm trying to talk in kind of a straight line, and you're behaving very nicely, but I'm distracted by all the people in my head. I have a committee up there, and they analyze everything that's going on. And in fact, they'll make a suggestion as to what I ought to talk about. And then one over here will have, no, don't talk about that, talk about this. And the third will say, oh, no, don't talk about that, talk about this. And they get to fighting among themselves about what I should talk about. And it's very distracting for me to try to talk to you with them chattering away up there like that. And I'll think, oh, shut up up there. And they'll all shut up, and I can't think of anything to say. My life is based not on what happens. And it really isn't based on what happens. It's who I listen to of what they're talking about what happens. In fact, my relationship with Max, it doesn't depend on what she does. It depends on who of the people in my head I listen to who are talking to me about what she does. You know, there's there's two sides to every question up there. And two comments. One of the guys up there, is obsessed with Max. He's been watching her as long as we've known each other, which is back to when we were 4 years old, which is about 72 years. He's been watching her and reporting back to me what she says and how she said it. And he doesn't particularly care for her. And did you hear the tone of voice in which she just spoke to you? Things like that. But yet there's another one up there who's been just as obsessed with her for just as long. He thinks she's terrific. Thinks she has a great sense of humor. Thinks she's attractive. Thinks that I'm lucky to have her. Likes to remind me that she's the one that kept going to AA when I wanted to quit. And she would go to meetings without me. And often encouraged me to go to meetings. A lot of times I'd say, well, let's go to a show. And she'd say, no, I want to go to a meeting. And so my relationship with Max depends on which of the two people up there I listen to. And in fact, my whole life depends on who are the people up there I listen to. There's only one up there that wants me to have a drink. The only one that wants me to see me drink. And his answer to every situation, good, bad, or indifferent, is, well, let's have a drink. Let's have a drink. And now I've got the other thing. Gee, I'm glad you can't hear what I have to listen to. Because a lot of the ideas are not only illegal, but they're lewd. But I found out that I can say to him, well, thank you for participating. Now, if you'll sit down, I'll call on somebody else. I got a meeting going on all the time in my head. And I'm out of the meeting even when I'm alone. That's why I have to be careful when I... in fact, somebody... A lot of times anymore, I'm talking this evening to somebody about... I talk to my higher power when I'm walking and jogging and on the treadmill and when I'm... in the car alone, that's my favorite time to talk my higher powers in the car. And somebody asked me, and I love the third step prayer and the third step and the seventh step prayer and the Lord's Prayer. In fact, when I awaken in the morning, I will say the Serenity Prayer, third step prayer, and the seventh step prayer. And then at breakfast, Max and I will say those prayers, and then we have a couple of things we read, then we have our meditation. And then we go through the day, and through the day I'll often say those prayers. And somebody said, did I get nervous in that before I was a talk like this? And I said, well, not really, in that what I do with something like that is I'll say to God, the third step prayer is, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. And I will say to God, God, I offer myself and this situation to you to do with whatever you want. Relieve me of the bondage of self. And now I would like to have it turn out what I would call successful. But if you want me to make a complete ass of myself in front of all those people, if that's the way you want to get your jollies tonight, so at least one of us will have a good time to do whatever you want. There's your back. That didn't take too long. You want me to review what you missed, or I just let him decide. In fact, I will often say to him, "You ignore what I've been telling you about what I like and what I want, what I think I should have, and don't do anything my way, unless it happens to coincide with what you already had in mind." In fact, I remember the first time I did the third step prayer. And I said to God, you make happen today whatever you want to have happen. And you have come into my life, whoever you want to have come into my life. And you have them say whatever you want them to say. And have them do whatever you want them to do. And whatever happens today, I'll know that's your will for me. Whatever happens today, whoever comes into my life, whatever they say and do, I'll know that's your will for me. Now you go have a good day today and I'll have a good day. Now the first time I did that, I thought, my God. I wonder how he's going to handle all the power I just gave him. You know? And yet he's never abused it. He's never abused it. And it's gone well with me. And I, one of the things that happens the most, one of the things that's the most different about me today compared to before I got sober is attitude. I was told early in sobriety that AA stands for altered attitudes. And my attitude is entirely different than it was when I came in. And that the perhaps more important than the fact that my attitude is different is that my belief as to where my attitude comes from is different. I came to the program thoroughly convinced that naturally my attitude and your attitude was a reflection of whatever was going on in my life or in your life. If you had my life, you'd have my attitude. If you had my life, you'd have my problems. And I found out that's not true. I was exercising a choice when I was using whatever is going on in my life. I was using that as an excuse for the attitude I had chosen. My attitude, I remember years back, I had clipped something out of the newspaper. It was a little blurb about a man left his apartment with another man, and they were down the street, and they came to a newsstand to buy a magazine or newspaper. And the clerk was very rude, had a terrible attitude. And the man was very kind and very generous, very nice, very gentlemanly to him. And as they walked along, the other man said, "How come you come here every day and you buy that paper every day? Why do you buy it from him when he has such a rotten attitude?" And his answer was that, "I'm not going to let that man determine my mood, my attitude. My attitude, my mood is too important to turn it over to somebody I don't even like and have them decide it for me." I've come to realize that my attitude is my choice. If it's a rotten attitude, it's because I'm choosing a rotten attitude. And I think it's, and it has a lot to do with us being here this weekend, as a matter of fact. I mean, Annette and Steve and Guy and Club Med people have worked like fiends to give us everything we need to have a tremendous week. And yet everything that every one of them has done to put it together is not going to be as important for each one of us as individuals than what our attitude is toward what they've done. And that's our responsibility, to add our attitude. In fact, I think life is 90% attitude. 90% attitude. In fact, it's getting late and we didn't come here to stay all night to listen to me. But let me close on this one belief that I have. Maybe nobody else has. In fact, I'm sure that tomorrow Father Tom's going to give you a different approach. But my idea is that, you know, I've been told all my life that when we die, we'll have a pre-admission interview with St. Peter and see if we're going to get in or not. And I don't think they'd tell us that if it wasn't true. But I've never met anybody that's had the interview and said it's true. So I have my own theory. I think if we do have a pre-admission interview, I think the things Pete is going to say, the thing he's going to ask us is, what was your predominant mood, your predominant attitude while you were down there? And if you think, well, gee, you probably want to know about me feeling guilty. If I said, I know you have been taught that we're very obsessed with guilt up here. But right now, the first thing I want to know is, what was your mood? And if you say, well, why do you want to know about my mood? You'll probably say, well, I know that you know that this is a place of happiness, peace, and joy. What you don't know is how we keep it that way. The people that are disgruntled, unhappy, resentful, complaining, whiners, victims, they go someplace else. And what we want to know, in fact, you're standing over the trapdoor. And so he'd very likely say, well, with that in mind, what was your predominant mood down there? And so my thought is that that's what we're supposed to do in life. That's my job in life. for me to enjoy life and enjoy this life, whether I like it or not. And I hope you do too. I'm just really glad to be here. I'm glad you're here. Well, my home number is, we live in the 714 area, and my number is 240-3940. And I love hearing from you, and I hope I get to know all of you real well before this is over. I guarantee you that even if I get to know you real well, I won't remember your name. I have dysnomia. I'm sick. And if you, I'm not self-centered and selfish, and so, and that's not why I have dysnomia. I can't read. It's a form of dyslexia. I know all about dysnomia and dyslexia. It's a form of dyslexia. You can't remember names and faces. I know all about that because I read it one time in the Los Angeles Times. So don't be upset at me. Just love me anyway. I love you. I just can't remember your name. And let's have a wonderful weekend. Enjoy ourselves, whether we like it or not. Thank you.